What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. I'm trying to think differently, said the president in India, and he meant think differently about nuclear weapons. For decades, the United States has helped lead the nuclear nonproliferation movement. 20 years ago, huge numbers of Americans were standing up for a nuclear freeze. In India, George W. Bush thought differently, accepting India's nuclear weapons program and, some say, boosting it. Congress must now decide whether to endorse the deal. But already, from India to Pakistan to the dreams of nuclear wannabes around the world, the 21st century looks like a time of nuclear opportunity. Up next on Point, from hopes of a freeze to fear of a free-for-all, Jonathan Schell, Ashton Carter, Richard Boucher, and more on nuclear weapons in a new century. Joining me now to look at next steps for the U.S.-India deal is David Sanger, White House correspondent for The New York Times. David, thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you, Tom.
So the president has sealed the deal with the Indian prime minister, but Congress must approve. What's the response so far been in Washington? What's the outlook?
It's been very mixed, and there are many who believe that in the end the president will get this through, but it's certainly not going to be easy. You know, Tom, in listening to the way that you described this at the opening there, it struck me that whether you think this deal is a good idea or not may depend in part on whether you're looking at it as a United States-India deal or whether you are looking at it in terms of the future of proliferation. In terms of strengthening the American relationship in India and helping position us in South Asia, it's certainly good. It recognizes a reality, and the reality is that India is a nuclear power. It's not going to give up its nuclear weapons. It's not going to sign the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, no matter how many times we ask it to. And clearly, it's going to keep producing some amount of nuclear fuel for its nuclear weapons. And the administration's argument is, look, these folks have had nuclear weapons for a while. They've been pretty responsible about it. And that's why they won't give it to Pakistan, because obviously the AQ Khan network, the
Very different story.
If you look at it in terms of proliferation, it's a lot more complex, because what you've done basically is carve an exception to the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty without rewriting the treaty. And there would be two ways to go about doing this. One would be to say the NPT isn't working, let's go rewrite it. The other way is to say the NPT isn't working, so let's carve some exceptions for people who we believe to be trusted powers, even if they haven't signed it, and let's keep even the basic processes out of the hands of countries like Iran, which have signed it.
As it stands, David Sanger, Congress is going to have to what? To rewrite U.S. law or make an exception? What does Congress need to do to give President the all clear here?
Well, part of the president's problem here is that the American law is written to forbid any nuclear technology exports to any country that is not a signatory to the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty.
And, of course, India is not.
Is not and won't become one. So the first order question is, do you amend the law to make an exception for India? Then the second question is, what do you do when the pressure comes in to deal with another close American ally that also hasn't signed the NPT, Israel, which is going to look at this and say, gee, this isn't a bad deal the Indians got, and we're as good allies or better than the United States than they are. Maybe we could begin to get the same deal.
Or for that matter, when Pakistan turns to China, if and when, the U.S. is agreeing in this deal to supply civilian technology to power plants, but critics are saying this will free India up to make more nuclear weapons. What's the chain of logic there?
You know, nuclear fuel, like oil and money, is fungible. The Indians have a limited amount of uranium that they can use to begin to produce nuclear fuel. So far, they have been dividing that between their civilian plants and their military programs, which make weapons. Now what's happening is the U.S. is going to supply, if the deal goes through, uranium for the civilian side and say, look, we're only supplying civilian plants. True, we are. But what that does is free up India's indigenous supplies for its military program.
Congress, Republican-led Congress, has become a little less leadable by President Bush recently. Does it look like they'll finally line up on this one, or could they push back, a la Dubai ports deal?
They could well push back, and I think that a lot of that depends on how much political capital the president has. This is a much harder issue out in the hustings for people to sort of get their hands around than the ports deal is. There's a visceral reaction to the ports deal because we all think we understand port security, even if, you know, whether or not we do or we don't. Whereas this gets into, you know, a lot of the complexities of the second nuclear age. I think the president's chances with this would be a lot higher. Also, the India lobby is quite a strong one here. There are a lot of businesses that are moving into India, as you know, and they're all going to be very much in favor of anything that strengthens the relationship.
David Sanger in Washington, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
David Sanger, White House correspondent for The New York Times. We will hear in this hour from Richard Boucher of the State Department, just back from India. But first, joining me now in the studio is Jonathan Schell, who drew national attention to the nuclear freeze movement with his 1982 book, The Fate of the Earth. He's peace and disarmament correspondent for The Nation magazine, a fellow at the Nation Institute, a visiting fellow at Yale, and author of The Unconquerable World, Power, Nonviolence, and the Will of the People. Jonathan Schell, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Also with me in the studio is Ashton Carter, co-director of the Preventive Defense Project at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He's also a professor of science and international affairs. From 93 to 96, he served as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under Bill Clinton. He is co-chair of Republican Senator Richard Lugar's Policy Advisory Group and testified before Congress in November on a nuclear deal with India. Ash Carter, thank you for being with us.
Good to be here.
Jonathan Schell, we want to look at this big, broad strokes, and you've been a leader in doing that over time. What's the era we're heading into generally? What's the era with this deal?
Well, you know, I was very struck by a phrase that was used by Mr. Manmohan Singh, Bush's counterpart in
India. Indian Prime Minister, yes.
Indian Prime Minister. And he said that with this deal, India joins, and I quote, a new nuclear world order. And I think it's very instructive to look at this from an Indian point of view, because what they're suggesting is that this is a model, and they used to speak of a kind of nuclear, a new nuclear paradigm, which they sought to join. And what they meant was that all of the great powers of the earth, China, United States, Russia, et cetera, possessed nuclear weapons, and that this possession, a kind of club of nuclear weapons, really constituted a world order and one that was highly beneficial to humanity, and that India was destined and determined to join this club and to join this new world order. So really what we have is something that's about as far as you can get as a vision of a world in which proliferation is stopped, in which nuclear weapons are reduced until, as I would hope, they are gone. It points the way very, very clearly to a world of unlimited and unconstrained proliferation. This whole deal is an absolute torpedo aimed at the midship of the whole nuclear nonproliferation regime, and its mischief can scarcely be calculated.
The details are many. Congress will be looking at them. But when you step back and think of back to 82, The Fate of the Earth came out, fast forward 20, 25 years here, did you expect the world would find itself in this situation?
Well, I thought we'd still be in the Cold War, to be perfectly honest with you. But when the Cold War ended, I did entertain the hope that we would begin a downward slope on nuclear weapons that would one day end with them being gone altogether. That turned out to be drastically premature. The world did not take that direction. Even before 9/11, it didn't. But then in 9/11, really, there began what I think of as a kind of nuclear renaissance. And I think that's what we're in the midst of now.
Both as in more nuclear weapons, the comeback.
Well, it's more a matter of more states with nuclear weapons.
Yes.
And then of a kind of retargeting of the nuclear arsenal, certainly of the United States, away from Russia and towards so-called rogue states and so on and so forth. So that you really have a situation of that's looming up of kind of nuke against nuke, so to speak. And of course, that's the very new nuclear world order that Prime Minister Singh has believes he's joining and that he loves. It's just about the biggest step I've seen since Dr. Strangelove was made to stopping worrying and learning to love the bomb.
Ash Carter, this is a nuclear deal, but not only a nuclear deal. So when you do the big calculus against the torpedoing, the learn to love the bomb scenario that Jonathan Schell describes,
and the nearer-term advantages of strategic cooperation with India. And you look at the threat of nuclear war or proliferation, even to the hands of terrorists, is it a good deal?
I think it's a good deal. The irony here is that neither the pros that the administration have been touting nor the cons that the nonproliferation community have been concerned about are as serious as either side contends. Let's start with the cons first. Is this a torpedo amidships, the nonproliferation regime? I don't think so. India has had nuclear weapons for 30 years. Nothing in this deal will stop India from making more if they choose to. On the other hand, they had that option beforehand. Our concerns around the world about nuclear weapons are far less with India, which has behaved extremely well with respect to selling technology and so forth abroad. Our concerns ought to be with North Korea and Iran.
But what about that firewall? The idea was it stops here. This is the nuclear club. It can't grow. In fact, it's supposed to shrink. Now, maybe you'd say that's been gone, but now isn't it formally gone?
I would go to Pyongyang and to Tehran, Tom, and I'd ask, does what we did in India really affect the calculus in Tehran and Pyongyang? I don't think they care that much what the president did in India. They are making bombs for a whole host of other reasons, very important reasons, a very serious concern. But I think this gives them one more talking point in their arguments, but is not the serious cause of proliferation in either of the two places we're most concerned about, Tehran or Pyongyang.
Jonathan,
if I can just say, on the good side, also the administration is saying that this partnership, which they're inaugurating with India, which I agree is very important, that it was necessary to make this nuclear concession. I don't believe that either. For 30 years,
we could have had a good relationship with India without doing this?
We accepted the Indian talking point of 30 years standing, which said that we have this psychological issue, which is we've made nuclear weapons and no one is recognizing that fact. If you don't recognize that fact, we can't have strategic partnership. I would have called their bluff on that. I thought that was a bluff. I don't think we needed to take this move in order to have strategic partnership with India.
This deal is a big deal, but we want to stay bigger at the same time. In this century, Ashton Carter, do you believe nuclear weapons are going to be part of many, many arsenals before this century is out? The vision that was the nightmare scenario for everybody at the dawn of the nuclear age.
Well, I certainly hope not, and it was the case, and it's been the constant of the nuclear age that in every decade we have predicted more nuclear powers than have transpired. Now, I don't mean to be Pollyannish in saying
that. And yet
every
decade there have been more.
But let's get back to what really concerns us today, which is North Korea and Iran. The administration has done nothing about those two problems. I can well see criticizing them for that, and I do. But is this India deal going to spell the difference in Tehran or Pyongyang? I think it's of second order importance.
Jonathan Schell, is the deal kind of so what in Tehran and Pyongyang? And are we headed toward this? Everybody's got a nuke in the closet sooner or later.
You know, for me, the question on the table is what kind of a vision do we have for the nuclear future in the 21st century? Are we looking to a future in which the number of nuclear weapons are reduced, nuclear powers are reduced, and eventually nuclear weapons are gone? Or, on the other hand, are we moving towards a world of proliferation? And the importance of this deal has to do with the signal that it sends about U.S. policy, because it clearly points the United States in the direction of what it seems to consider as a kind of controlled proliferation in which supposedly good countries are permitted to have nuclear weapons and those that are supposedly bad are not permitted to have them. To me, that is an unsustainable vision. It's a it doesn't work in practice, and already Ash Carter has made mention of North Korea and Iran. It's an unworkable vision, and that's where this points us. So, really, it's a kind of abdication. It's a kind of throwing in the towel in a de facto way. And by the way, we do see this with reference to North Korea and Iran because they have no policy. They have no measures to take there.
That is the Bush administration.
The Bush administration. So there's a peculiar consistency that's emerging here, which is one of indifference to proliferation, and a kind of embrace, really, of what Prime Minister Singh is calling the new nuclear world order.
You say no policy, but we've certainly heard a lot about it from this administration. Jonathan Schell, Ashton Carter, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation for a moment here Richard Boucher. He is was State Department spokesman since 2000, is the newly named Assistant Secretary of State for South and Central Asia, just back from India and Pakistan, where he was with the president. Mr. Boucher, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Tom. It's good to be with you.
So are you, as Jonathan Schell accuses, embracing controlled proliferation? Is that the new way?
No, it's not. This is a deal that brings a country that has been developing nuclear programs, it brings them into the non-proliferation mainstream.
So what's the different thinking that President Bush is describing? He says, I want to think differently. How would you describe it, Richard Boucher?
Well, I think it's differently than holding an absolutist position, that there are countries that have developed weapons or have developed weapons programs, but nobody is in the position that India has been, and that they've got an excellent record on nuclear nonproliferation. They've been bringing their other export controls up to the levels of other countries. They've been a responsible country, and as they develop nuclear power, I think it's better for us to be cooperating with them than not. The fact is that some 19% of their nuclear capacity is under safeguards now. This will bring it up to 65%, and over time, as they build more reactors, it'll bring it to 90%.
That sounds like
so
controlled
if you want them
proliferation.
You've got to get them in.
You've got to get them in, but get them into what? I mean, it sounds like controlled proliferation. You're making a judgment there. They have nukes, they've handled themselves well, so they're in. I mean, what happens in 10 years if there's a new government there and they're not so responsible?
Well, I mean, first of all, India is a democratic country that has a certain tradition, a certain history, and I wouldn't project out, I wouldn't have feel uncomfortable projecting India out 10 years, whereas I certainly would feel uncomfortable projecting Iran or North Korea out 10 years.
What about Pakistan? What if China describes in 10 or 5 years that Pakistan deserves more nuclear support along the lines of what the U.S. has just done with India?
We've made very clear that India's situation is different. It's not in the cards for other people.
I mean, the United States has made that clear.
Nobody's got a record.
But China has its own. But China could make something. They could say, "Here's the precedent. We interpret Pakistan differently. We're going to support Pakistan on this front."
They could, but they'd have to get consensus in the nuclear suppliers to do that, and that would require not only agreement by the United States, but agreement by other countries. And I think you'll find virtually nobody sees Pakistan as being in a similar situation as India, and I don't think there's any chance that would go through.
How do you see,
particularly with our opposition?
How do you see nuclear weaponry unfolding in this century, Richard Boucher? Do you look forward and imagine that, I mean, I'm not sure, what is the total number now? It's still relatively small, but will it be double that in 20 years' time? Are we going to see nuclear weapons as a standard element of arsenals by the end of this century? Can the world live with that?
I certainly hope not. I don't think that's where we're headed. I think there are a couple things we need to do. We need to, first of all, prove the virtues of countries that have decided to give up their nuclear weapons programs or their nuclear programs. And there are a number of countries that did that, particularly in the immediate post-Soviet period, that have gotten the benefits of doing that. Second of all, we need to make clear that the suppliers and others who are involved already with nuclear technology need to have a tighter and a better regime. And indeed, we're promoting various new kinds of technologies and arrangements so that countries can have nuclear power without having a greater proliferation risk. And third of all, we need to bring as many countries as possible into the non-proliferation mainstream. Now, in India's case, that means finding areas where we can even work with them on some of these projects, but to get all countries to raise the effort, the level of their vigilance, so that they're not sources of proliferation.
Decades ago now, President Kennedy said the weapons of war, and he was talking nuclear weapons, must be abolished before they abolish us. What about abolition? Is that a 20th century idea? Is the future all about managing nuclear weapons? Is disarmament out the window?
I don't think disarmament's out of the window. In fact, the United States has, you know, got a treaty with Moscow to reduce thousands and thousands of nuclear weapons over the next few years, and that comes, I think, to fruition about 2012, if I remember correctly. But the lowering the numbers of nuclear weapons is a process that we are doing and will continue to do. But I don't know that it's in itself sufficient to make the world safer. We have to increase the vigilance on nonproliferation and make it harder for countries to develop them.
Richard Boucher, recently named Assistant Secretary of State for South and Central Asia. Mr. Boucher, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, Tom. Thank you very much.
Thanks for being with us. Ashton Carter, there's the administration's, it's his bailiwick right now there in South Asia, India. And he says this is consistent with non-proliferation.
Well, I think that's going too far either. There's no way you can characterize what we did with India as helpful in the cause of non-proliferation. The question is whether the damage is severe and whether anything like the characterization of a torpedo amidships is accurate. And let's put this in some perspective. I don't think the administration did this very well. And as I said earlier, I don't think they had to do it in order to have strategic partnership with India. But let's look at the big nuclear picture here. Where are we? What are we concerned about? Should we be concerned about in the coming decades? Number one, that terrorists like Al Qaeda will get their hands on fissile material somehow.
More or less likely after the India deal.
Doesn't make any difference. Okay. The Indians have kept their arsenal very tight. They've had no AQ-Con type leakage. Second, Iran. Third, North Korea. What matters there is the thinking of the regimes in those two capitals. Their thinking is principally dominated by their concerns about their own security and their own position in their own region. Whether India is recognized for something it has had for 30 years or not, it's just inconceivable, and I don't think anyone contends that the mullahs in Tehran or Kim Jong-il in Pyongyang are materially influenced by that. Next, loose nukes in Russia. Does Russian custody and control of their arsenal, does that depend upon what we say about a long-standing fact in India? So whether you think this is a good deal or a bad deal, a timely deal, a raw deal for the United States, whatever, when you look at it in the perspective of the big nuclear picture, this does not go to the heart of where our concerns need to be. And to call it a torpedo amidships, I simply think is overblown.
Jonathan Schell, there's a torpedo back at your word.
I don't want to belabor this torpedo business.
But you said Strangelove. Let's learn to love the bomb. Ashton Carter says it's just being very realistic.
Well, because I think that what the United States does and the signals that it sends out to the world, especially with respect to nuclear weapons, are of absolutely global importance and change every calculation in every capital where these things are being considered, from North Korea to Brazil. Because one of the things that any leader is going to be asking themselves is, what kind of a world are we going to be living in? And when they look at this, they can only see that new nuclear world order that Singh is talking about. And they're going to have to conclude, we are going to be living in a world of growing number of nuclear powers, and so we better get into that game.
Period,
too.
End of story. Let's get in there.
Yes, absolutely. Let me be a little more concrete here. Because the local consequences of such a deal as this cannot be separated from the global ones.
Local as in South Asia.
That's right. Because just consider, India cites China as the reason for its nuclearization, also cites Pakistan. Pakistan and China are allied. But China, in turn, is responding to American moves as well as the Indian. So what you have a recipe for here is a pan-Asian nuclear arms race, which is already underway, by the way, but to let it go farther and really increase it. And that cannot have a good impact on decisions that are made in Pyongyang, for instance, and even beyond that to Japan, where they have a couple thousand tons of plutonium ready to roll in 6 months to make into bonds if they choose to do so. So now these are eventualities that aren't going to happen tomorrow. We can hope and trust, although there have been a few mutterings in Japan along these lines. But these are the kinds of consequences that unroll at a rather slow pace, it's been true, slower than some thought originally. But this is the direction, this is the way it's going, and that's why it's such an important signal of American policy that we not only tolerate, but have adopted a kind of AQ-Con policy of actually helping out India in its nuclear weapon program by freeing up those fuels that otherwise it would have had to devote or may have devoted to civilian power, because there's an actual concrete result here as well.
I'm sure Richard Boucher would describe it otherwise, but we hear that. We've been joined by Ashton Carter. He's co-chair of Senator Richard Lugar's Policy Advisory Group. He's testified before Congress on the nuclear deal with India. We're joined by Jonathan Schell, author of The Unconquerable World, and right now from Washington by Robert Einhorn, senior advisor in the Center for Strategic and International Studies, International Security Program. From November 1999 to August 2001, he was Assistant Secretary for Nonproliferation at the Department of State. Robert Einhorn, thank you for joining us.
Glad to join you, Tom.
Big picture, where are we headed here? In a better direction, worse, or neutral with the India deal?
I think we're headed slightly in a negative direction. I wouldn't go so far as Jonathan Schell has gone in terms of its disastrous effect. I wouldn't be as positive, though, as Ash Carter. I think the deal sends some troublesome messages. It sends the message that you play by the nonproliferation rules when it's convenient for you. But when you have other considerations, foreign policy, commercial, and so forth, then perhaps nonproliferation takes a back seat. And I'm concerned that the U.S. has been the world leader against proliferation. Most countries follow our lead. And when we send the signal that nonproliferation is not necessarily our top priority, then others may follow suit, and they may begin acting in a way that we consider irresponsible, but they'll simply be following our lead.
What are the big dynamics that you see around this question, Robert Einhorn? What direction are we headed in here? Do you see nuclear weapons becoming more and more common as elements in national arsenals? Is that the path we're on?
I don't think proliferation is inevitable. We have some very damaging trends now, and I agree with Ash Carter that North Korea and Iran are the most troublesome things, because if they if North Korea retains its nuclear weapons and Iran gets nuclear weapons, then there'll be lots of countries in those regions, Northeast Asia and the Middle East, who will reconsider their nuclear options and perhaps decide to go nuclear too. But even if North Korea and Iran both go nuclear, it doesn't necessarily mean we're sliding down the slippery slope. A key factor will be the role of the United States. If the United States is a reliable security partner for countries like South Korea and Japan, or for Turkey and Saudi Arabia, then those countries may not feel they have a strong incentive to go nuclear themselves. But there are some damaging trends, and you have AQCON and black market networks around the world making access to enabling nuclear technology much easier, and that's very, very worrisome.
And materially on Iran, which is first on the burner here, how do you see the India deal influencing that? I mean, that's in the headlines right now. Does the India deal help, hurt? Which way does it lean?
Yeah. Well, obviously, Iran has been seeking nuclear weapons for over 20 years. This deal hasn't affected their basic motivation. I think what this deal does them is give them a convenient argument. They can credibly charge that the U.S. has a double standard. And, Iran makes this case with its own public to justify its actions and with the international community, especially the non-aligned countries who are sympathetic with their concerns. So Iran says, look, we're an NPT party, and the United States isn't even allowing us to exercise our right to have an enrichment plant. But yet, here's India. It spurned the NPT treaty. It has nuclear weapons, and the U.S. is prepared to engage in nuclear cooperation with it. Now, we all know the fallacies in that argument, but it's a convincing argument to lots of people. So, does it affect their motivation? No. Does it make it harder for us to mobilize support against Iran? Yes.
Ashton Carter, is there an appearance or a reality of a double standard here that raises the Iran's ability to work its political will toward nuclear weaponry?
Undeniably. And that's why I said that doing this for India is inconvenient in terms of defending the nonproliferation regime against the arguments by those, for example, in Iran, who would say, hey, look at what you're doing for India. What about our case? My point is simply, and I think Bob was echoing this, that that's not the root motivation in the case of Iran. It's not the root motivation in the case of North Korea. It's not the root motivation in the case of Osama bin Laden. It's not the root motivation in the case of Japan and South Korea, who might go nuclear if North Korea does. So this whole idea of a powder train that begins in India is the the thing I think is overblown. At the same time, Bob's absolutely right, and no one has done more than Bob Einhorn to establish us as a principled, our principles on nonproliferation. This compromises those principles. The only way to feel better about that is to look at the larger frame and to say that, yes, it's a compromise of these principles, but the damage is not a torpedo. It's nothing like a torpedo. And we did it in order to establish with India a security relationship and a position for India, a large democracy in the world, that we believe, and I certainly believe, that in the long run is going to contribute much more to world security, including to proliferation, than would continuing to pretend that India doesn't have the bomb. Now, I think that was the logic of the administration's move, and to that extent, I support the logic. I think that the way they've handled it is very poor. I think Congress is going to be an issue. We're going to have to take a look at it. Bob Einhorn's in the group that reports to Senator Lugar with me, and I think probably Congress is going to request some changes. So this is not a great moment in diplomacy. It was poorly done by the Bush administration. My only message to your listeners here is that if they're concerned about nuclear weapons and the spread of nuclear weapons, they should be. But this is not a match in a powder keg. This is something much, much less than that.
Jonathan Schell?
Yeah, let me speak about this, the question, because I think it's a very interesting discussion. Of course, it's perfectly obvious that Iran is not seeking the bomb because the U.S. made a nuclear deal with India, nor is Pyongyang. That would be ridiculous. The damage, the severe, severe damage that's done to the future prospects for nonproliferation here has to do with the following, in my opinion. It's that in order for countries to decide, no, we won't go down this path, or maybe having gone partway down this path, we'll get off it again, they have to be able to see a vision of a world that is resolute and united in upholding the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty and the other aspects of the regime, such as the Nuclear Suppliers Group and all and U.S. law and so forth, that permits them to think that that is going to be a wise decision for them to do without nuclear weapons. Now, this deal—
That they won't be the only sucker left without one.
Exactly. And what this deal does is to say that the United States, the most powerful actor on the scene, is ready to reverse those rules. It will require actual emendation of its own laws, of the Nuclear Supplier Group rules, and maybe conceivably of the nonproliferation treaty rules themselves, or some may regard that they have just been violated. So it's the taking away of that positive alternative that would allow nations to make better decisions that is the high price here, and that justifies, in my opinion, this use of the torpedo word, the T word, if I may use call
Ash,
it that.
Yeah.
I've said now several times that much of the dynamics of proliferation is, in fact, local and not global. But there is a global dimension that I think is very important, and it's not the one that Jonathan's pointing to, but it's something different. We, in order not to have a continued disaster in our environment and global warming, to reduce dependence on oil, we're going to have more nuclear power around the world.
This is the president's point.
Future. Well, it's many people's point.
Well, but I mean, he made it specifically in the tape we played at the top of this show, which makes it sound like an environmental issue, a pocketbook issue.
It's an important issue, and many people have concerns about nuclear power. But the fact of the matter is that the spread of nuclear power around the world is important, necessary, and inevitable.
Is weapons proliferation
necessary? My real concern, and the real global issue here, is how can we have nuclear power around the world without the spread of the capacity to make uranium and plutonium, which are the things that bombs can be made out of? That's a very important question. The India deal doesn't bear upon it that much. But if you want to look at the nonproliferation regime and its integrity going forward and ask ourselves decades hence, will we have a nonproliferation regime? The ball to keep your eye on is this spread of nuclear power and whether in its wake is going to spread fissile material that is just someday some regime, some terrorist is going to get their hands off and one will go off in Boston or New York.
You say it's not related to the India deal, but of course critics point out that, as you yourself say, production is fungible. India, if it's now provided with material by the United States, has more capacity to pour that into bomb making if it chooses to. Joe's calling from Washington, D.C. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. My question is going to go back to your quote from Arundhati Roy and some comments made during the program that the biggest foreseeable threat to the United States is, over the next 10 years, is the acquisition of nuclear weapons by Iran or terrorists or expansion of the North Korean nuclear capability. But I wonder if you can discuss this issue while totally ignoring the fact that as we speak, the United States and Russia have 2,000 weapons apiece on high alert that if the commanders, the leaders decide to launch, could wipe out civilization in 30 minutes.
Joe, put an edge on that. You heard Richard Boucher say earlier, we're drawing down the numbers at that level. Is this really your fear today?
That's absolutely false. And the Moscow Treaty would even allow a higher number than 2,000.
But are you really afraid of an exchange between Russia and the United States? I mean, Ash Carter points to terrorists getting the bomb, a city going up, but not that kind of Cold War exchange. Is that still top of your concern list?
Well, listen, accident, we've come close many times already to accidental launch. We have Dr. Strangelove that shows what can happen if a madman decides to step in. And then you have to ask, why would rational parties maintain these arsenals if they didn't anticipate using them? The longer they're there, the more inevitable use becomes.
Joe, we've got it. Thanks for your call. Robert Einhorn, stepping back here, Ashton Carter says it's not a powder train that starts in India and goes out to the rest of the world. And yet, anybody who looks at this over time can see there are now more countries with nuclear weapons and headed in that direction than there were. So how is this train turned? How is it turned in a different direction? Are we being essentially told you're going to have to live with a world with more nukes gradually? It may be slow, but inevitably over time. Or can it actually be turned back to the kind of sentiment of Dwight Eisenhower or JFK saying, let's get away from these?
You have to do a number of things to prevent nuclear proliferation to turn into a stampede. The main thing you have to do is to deal with the toughest cases, the North Korea, Iran. I think rolling back North Korea and stopping Iran is the single most important thing you can do to make sure that countries in unstable regions don't get nuclear weapons.
But we've already heard on this show very serious strategic thinkers saying you're not going to stop Iran at this point.
Well,
people disagree on that, but serious thinkers are saying that out loud.
Yeah, you may not be able to stop Iran, but so far Iran doesn't see much cost in continuing down the path it's going. I think the world has got to make it plain to Iran that if it continues down this path, there will be very, very strong penalties.
Condoleezza Rice is already saying that, but it hasn't changed Iran's path yet.
Well, you know, all the members of the Security Council, and especially Russia and China, have to say unambiguously to Iran, if you continue down this path, your future is not going to be very bright. They haven't done that yet. But another way of, you know, preventing widespread proliferation, I think, is to deal with the problem that Ash alluded to a moment ago, the growth of nuclear power worldwide. And we can take steps to guarantee countries that they can have the nuclear energy they need without having creating proliferation risks. You can set up a regime, and you know this is already being studied, that ensures that countries like Iran don't have to have their own ability to make nuclear fuel, because you have the ability to make nuclear fuel.
Of course,
you have the ability to make nuclear weapons.
But look, Iran's got plenty of oil. It's not fuel thereafter. Allison's calling from Beverly, Massachusetts. Hi, Allison. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I don't want to wax nostalgic. I was at the march in 1982 in New York City. Mm-hmm. I was a 14-year-old high school student.
Biggest in history, our time short. What do you think today, Allison?
I think that back then there was a feeling of how people wanted the world in which they lived to be. And right now there's a feeling amongst people I know, in the very least, mm-hmm. that we are powerless and impotent against what the administration is doing in many things, including nuclear proliferation. And so my grandmother used to say, just because you can do something doesn't mean you should do something. And there's that kind of feeling that there's this, oh, well, this is going to happen anyway, so we might as well roll with it. And it's just such a different feeling. Everybody I know feels kind of powerless, and they've kind of given up, you know, this is going to happen, so what are we going to do? But nobody wants their children to grow up in the world that's happening right now.
We hear that, Allison, and it is a scary feeling. Our time is short. We've got 1 minute. Ashton Carter, how do you handicap it? And we hope you can come back and talk to us about this. 10 years out, 20, how many more nuclear players? Or does it stop here? Is there any chance of that?
I think there's every chance of slowing the spread of nuclear weapons, maybe even arresting it. The two cases on the table, as Bob Einhorn said right now, are Iran and North Korea. I give us some reasonably good chances of slowing Iran's program so that 10 years from now they don't have a bomb. North Korea, the administration has disastrously allowed essentially to go nuclear in the last 5 years. Nobody's talking about that. That's a regime that's a lot stranger than India. India is a large, multi-ethnic democracy. Its behavior has been perfectly good. You want to worry about something, worry about North Korea. But I don't think spread is inevitable.
Jonathan Schell, we've got half a minute. What, on the path we're on, where do you see us headed?
Well, I think a prediction is a fool's game. Nevertheless, I think you could easily see five or six new nuclear powers in the next 10 years. I can't be sure of that. The problem now is that we seem to have no coherent or consistent policy in the United States or in the world at large to prevent such an outcome. And framing and conceiving and imagining and putting into place such a policy is the order of business that I think is most important.
Well, our time is up. We're imagining today. Jonathan Schell, author of The Unconquerable World, thanks very much for being
thank
with
you.
Us. Ashton Carter from Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, thank you for joining
pleasure
us.
Pleasure to be here.
And Robert Einhorn in Washington at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Bob, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.